What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Jeremy Stalnecker. Jeremy seeks to help others answer one of the toughest questions we all face. How do I move forward when my world is falling apart? Jeremy is the CEO of the Mighty Oaks Foundation, dedicated to helping America's military warriors and their families who are suffering from the unseen wounds of combat, such as post-traumatic stress disorder. In addition to his current role, Jeremy has served as a Marine Corps infantry officer and as a senior pastor. He's an accomplished author, inspirational speaker, and a frequent guest on some of America's most prominent news networks. I spoke with him for about 45 minutes. It was a pleasure, and I think you'll enjoy it. And now I give you Jeremy Stalnecker. Okay, I'm here with Jeremy Stalnecker. Jeremy, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Appreciate it, Josh. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, I am too. There's so much I want to talk to you about, Jeremy. Certainly your life, which has been a storied one, no question, and what you've learned. But before I get there, I'd love for you to maybe describe yourself to someone who might not be familiar with you for our audience.
Sure. My current job or role in life, I'm a husband. I'm a father of four. I've got four kids. And vocationally, I run a veterans organization. We serve veterans, active duty service members, and first responders. Started working with veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress and combat trauma issues. And then over the last several years, I've also worked with first responders. We have programs across the country, so a national program, and focusing on really basically how to move forward beyond trauma. We all experience trauma. If your trauma is connected to combat or military service or service in the community, there are certainly unique layers to that. A lot of folks who are in those communities are dealing with trauma from their childhood and from their past that they then bring into the military or bring into their community service and deal with extreme traumatic events. And so we've had the opportunity to work with thousands of folks through our program. We speak on that often, and it's been a great privilege. I am able to do that work because years ago, I served in the United States Marine Corps. I was an infantry officer, served in a number of capacities, but right before I got out, it's kind of the last thing I did in the Marine Corps was deployed to Iraq in 2003 as part of the initial invasion into Iraq. So March 19th, 2003, our infantry battalion breached the berm, secured the southern objective in Iraq, went to Baghdad, came home, and then lived for 10 years trying to move past a lot of that and a lot of the struggles that came with that. Went into ministry of all things. I served on a church staff. And years later, so 10 or 12 years later, brought kind of all of my experiences together to where we have been able to do the work that we're doing now. And so it's been a pretty incredible journey. All I had ever wanted to do was be a Marine. I did that, left it, struggled, and learned a lot of lessons along the way, and now have the opportunity to help others move forward as well.
Yeah, no, excellent. Thank you, Jeremy. I would love to wind the clock back a little bit. Growing up, if my info was correct, you said that your life goal was to join the Marine Corps. I'd love to know, why was that? Why did you feel the impetus to serve?
It's crazy. So you and I have talked a little bit about this, but history is very important generally, but it's very important to me. And there are a lot of reasons for that. As a Marine, history is very, very important. Of all the military branches or services, the Marine Corps values their history, talks about history a lot. And I'm wired that way. And the reason I made a decision when I was young to go into the military and then particularly the Marine Corps, I've been asked that question a lot. I came from a patriotic family. My grandfather served in World War II, but my dad, no one that I knew, my close relatives had served. But my dad handed me a book when I was 10 or 12 years old. It was a book that he had had in the 60s. He was cleaning out some stuff from my grandparents' house, found this book. And just because I think he didn't want to throw it away, he gave it to me. And it was a book called They Met Danger. I actually have it. In fact, I think I have it here on my bookshelf. They Met Danger is written in, I think, 1962 or three. And it was written to boys to tell stories of Congressional Medal of Honor recipients from World War II. And so they were these stories, but they were written to young people. And I read that book cover to cover to cover. The binding has fallen off of it because after all of these years, I still go back and look at it. But that stirred in me this understanding that a person can be put in a really difficult situation and excel. They can move forward. They can overcome, and they can do things that are important and historically significant, and they can help others and protect others. And it began to turn my mind toward that way of looking at the world. And it's crazy what those stories can do, but certainly they did that for me. And then understanding in a family that valued service, that was, you know, something that is valuable and is important. So I always tell the story. My dad was a pastor, and I always talk about, you know, I was 14 years old. My dad and I were driving somewhere, and I said, "Hey, Dad, would it be okay if I didn't go into ministry? You know, I wasn't against ministry, but that's not what I wanted to do with my life." And he said, "Sure, you need to do whatever you believe you should do." And I said, "I think that God really wants me to enlist in the Marine Corps." And he's like, "God does not want you to enlist in the Marine Corps. That can't possibly be God. It's got to be something else." But from that point forward, that's what I pointed my life toward.
Wow. No, excellent. Thank you, Jeremy. So I'd love to know, what is it actually like? What is the infantry officer course at Quantico like? How long is it, and what does it entail? And perhaps what did you learn from it?
Yeah. So the infantry officer, or well, it's the officer candidate school is where you start. So that's a 10-week program in Quantico, Virginia, that every aspiring candidate at that time, anyone who aspires to be a Marine officer, has to go through that school. The easiest way to describe it is it's boot camp, but for those that want to be officers. Now, every Marine out there who heard me say that is going to say it's nothing like boot camp, right? But structurally, it's the same with some differences. The differences are there's a lot of leadership training. There is opportunities to drop out on request. You can decide to quit because you don't want to do that. Things that would be important for leadership to understand. And so there's a lot of emphasis on leadership, but it's very similar in format and goal to boot camp. And that was a crazy time, man. For me, again, not coming from a military family, I didn't know a lot about the military other than what I had read or maybe watched on TV or something like that. And one of the things about OCS is you're not given a lot of information. You're expected to figure things out. And so it was very overwhelming. It was very difficult, as it's supposed to be. And I learned, I think the one thing I learned, I guess, was how to persevere and how to stand up and keep moving forward. It was the first time in my life I'd gone to college, but as a protected environment, but first time in my life I'd really been away from my family, had not had the opportunity to reach out to people that had supported me and encouraged me. It was a very foreign environment, and I had to learn how to continue to move forward through that. So that was a valuable time. From there, Marine officers go from officer candidate school to another school called the Basic Officer Course. It's also in Quantico. You are a commissioned officer at that time. It's all second lieutenants. And that's the first school that all Marine officers go to. It's 6 months long, and it literally is a school on how to be a Marine officer. You learn the different functions of the Marine Corps and how to function as an officer in those different capacities. It's 6 months of exposure to just about everything the Marine Corps has to offer. Again, a difficult school. It was a lot of information very, very quickly, and things that I had just not been exposed to, overwhelming. But from there, your MOS, your military occupational specialty, is selected, and you go to what the other services call an A school or your MOS school, where you learn the specific skills you need to do the job you've been selected for. I was selected to be an infantry officer, which is what I requested. And I went to my final school, which is the infantry officer course, also in Quantico. I spent a lot of time in Quantico, so I don't like Quantico, but infantry officer course. And for me, OCS was difficult for a lot of reasons, adjustment and growing up. I think the basic officer course was overwhelming because of just the amount of knowledge and information. But infantry officer course was the first time in my time learning how to be a Marine officer that I felt like I was where I belonged. It was very focused on infantry. It was focused on tactics, techniques, procedures, how to lead Marines in combat. It was all of the things that I dreamed about when I was a 12-year-old kid reading They Met Danger and trying to put myself in the mind and in the place of someone in a combat environment leading other service members. Infantry officer course was an amazing time for me. 10 weeks of learning how to do the job I really felt called to. And then from there, you go and you pick up your platoon and you start doing the work.
Excellent, Jeremy. No, thank you. And I'm grateful to you for bringing up leadership. That dovetails rather nicely into my next question. So you served as the platoon commander of the counter-mechanized platoon. What was that like? And I'd love to know what leadership skills you learned from it. And also, what the heck is a counter-mechanized platoon?
Yeah, these are all great questions. So for those not familiar with the Marine Infantry Battalion, which is probably most people, the Marine Corps is organized, obviously, big organization down to smaller units. The Infantry Battalion of the 1st Marine Division, which is what I was a part of, I was part of then 5th Marine Regiment. That's several battalions. And then our battalion. Our battalion had about 1,200 Marines. That's fairly typical for an infantry battalion. And that battalion then is broken into platoons. So this is what people would be familiar with, smaller units. Each company in the battalion has a number of platoons, and that makes up the larger 1,200 Marine battalion. So that's a lot of words I just said. But I was a part of 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and served as a rifle platoon commander, as a second lieutenant. And then when I became a first lieutenant, I went to weapons company. And I'm getting to your point. And weapons company in the infantry battalion is where the big weapons are. Okay. So you're looking at machine guns, the big machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns, Mark 19, fully automatic grenade launchers, TOW missiles, which everyone has seen, the Humvee with the TOW missile on launcher on top of it, particularly coming out of Afghanistan, Iraq. I think everyone's familiar with that image. Anti-armor weapons like the Javelin system, those are all in weapons company. And when I went to weapons company, in a strange twist of fate, those are supposed to be a couple of different platoons. They were put into one, and we called that the counter-mechanized platoon. In that platoon, I had all the anti-armor assets. I had TOW missile launchers. I had heavy machine guns. I ended up with 84 Marines and 18 vehicles and a lot of leadership. So I say all of that, not because it's necessarily important to anyone, but it was an awful lot. It was very complex. We had a lot of moving parts, and it required a lot of leadership. One of the things that the Marine Corps does maybe the best job in the world at is developing leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting process. It's a process of teaching. You read books, you take classes, you learn leadership principles and traits. These things are taught to you very didactically, you know, in a classroom setting. But practically, it's an amazing process, and it's a process of mentorship. We don't call it that in the Marine Corps, but it's a process of mentorship. When I checked into 1st Battalion, 5th Marines as a second lieutenant, I had been to over a year of school, but I had no real practical experience leading Marines. I became a platoon commander of a small platoon, 40 Marines, but the senior enlisted person in that platoon was a staff sergeant at the time who not too long ago retired as a sergeant major, but a staff sergeant Zapata. He was a senior enlisted Marine in that platoon. He ran that platoon. And so when I took that platoon over as the platoon commander, I was technically in charge. I was certainly responsible, but a smart second lieutenant, and I wasn't smarter than average, but I knew I didn't know a lot, will lean on that staff NCO, that staff sergeant who's running that platoon, and learn from them. Mm. I learned so much about leadership of people and leadership of the unit and how to deal with the various things we had to deal with by allowing Staff Sergeant Zapata to teach me from his, you know, at that time, 15 years of experience of doing that, and really mentored me through that. And that process is essential anywhere in life to learn leadership. You need to have the understanding from a classroom perspective. You need to understand the principles, but you need to have people in your life that can say, hey, this is how you do that, or how you did that was not the right way, and really build practically the ability to lead in you. So that when I then went to the other platoon, the counter-mechanized platoon, and now I have 84 Marines and I have 18 vehicles I'm responsible for, and you know, millions of dollars worth of equipment and a lot of leadership in that platoon, I had learned in a smaller setting with a strong mentor how to handle that. And so I moved into that environment and I was able to continue to develop, of course, other good staff NCOs, other good leaders there that I could depend on and learn from. And that developed in me the ability to continue to learn, to grow, and more importantly, to lead. And the ultimate test of that is when you go into combat, which we eventually, you know, did. That was the platoon that I took to Iraq. And that's where you really learn, if you learned, and if you have the skills you need to take folks into an extremely difficult environment.
Yeah. No, excellent, Jeremy. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'd love to discuss that a little bit. So you were deployed to Kuwait in support of what would become Operation Iraqi Freedom. As you alluded to a little bit earlier, as the war began, your battalion went to breach the berm separating Kuwait and Iraq and securing what was basically defined as the first major objective of the war.
Right.
Yes, sir. I'd love for you to please take me through that experience as comfortable, you know, as much as you like.
Yeah, for sure. So it's funny, there's a lot behind that, right? And everything we just talked about, I used a lot of words, but all of the schooling, all of the education, all of the connections, and the growth personally. I was 25 years old when we deployed to Kuwait and had never obviously been in combat, had never led at that level, but there we were. And all of those experiences leading up to that moment were so essential in preparing me personally and then preparing us as a unit for what would happen. And that's important to say for people that may not see the value in what they're experiencing right now or their current struggles or what they're dealing with right now. Learn everything that you can every step along the way, because eventually those lessons will be put to test. And that's exactly what happened. I had trained with that platoon, thankfully, the counter-mechanized platoon, for almost 2 years. It was an unusual time frame. Doesn't normally work that way, but it did. We were one part of the battalion. Again, about 1,200 Marines, but because of the assets that we had, I navigated for our battalion. So I was the second vehicle back in our column. We provided security, and every objective that we hit, we were the first platoon. We were the first vehicles to hit that objective. So going from a training environment and a learning environment to a practical application environment in the middle of the night, we had prepared in Kuwait for a daytime breach of the berm and securing of the southern objective. Sitting on the southern border was a gas oil separation plant. Oil pipelines ran along the southern border, and our objective was to secure that intact so that it could continue to be used to provide fuel and other energy resources to the region. And we were going to do that during the daytime. It was assumed that that would be certainly simpler, and that the enemy presence there would not be strong enough to prevent that. So everything we did leading up to that was visual markers, visual. Everything was, we'll see this over there. You'll see that over there. You'll link up over there. Everything is in daylight hours. We were preparing, and there's a picture of this, of us having a final meeting before we were going to get our final preparation done to attack the next morning, to push into the country the next morning. And while that meeting was happening, the order was given by General James Mattis that we would move then. So instead of a daytime attack where all of our markers were visual, all of our link up signals were visual, we were now going to be moving in the middle of the night. And we did. Again, saying all of that to say, the years of training, the years of learning, the years of rehearsing, the years of understanding came into play at that moment. And I would not have anticipated that. And so we started to move in the middle of the night. There were three axes of advance going into Iraq. The one side was the 3rd Infantry Division of the Army. The other side was the 7th Marines, 7th Marine Regiment. And then the center axis was our regiment, 5th Marines, and it was our battalion, and it was my vehicles. So the berm was breached, a pathway was secured, and we moved through and began securing that southern objective. We moved through in the night because the Iraqi military had started to light those oil pipelines on fire, and we were trying to secure as much of that intact as possible. Mm-hmm. And so we moved in the middle of the night. It was a crazy, crazy environment, as you can imagine. Even with years of training, you never have people shooting back at you. And that was something that was new to all of us. It was this weird, like, other earthly situation where everything that was happening was something that you have been told your entire life is not supposed to happen. You are engaging humans. They are trying to engage you. Things are blowing up. They're out of control. They're on fire. It's the middle of the night, so it's kind of that dreamy thing anyhow. And it's just a crazy, crazy environment. The next morning, the first KIA of the war, Lieutenant Shane Childers, was killed there as he and his platoon were clearing some buildings. And we continued to move. That was the first day. And we made our way then over the next several weeks to Baghdad on April 10th. So it was a strange environment. It's funny how quickly things become normal, but that became our normal working environment throughout the rest of our time in Iraq. One of the kind of significant events that took place there, and this is something that in the media was well represented. We had reporters with us, which was pretty unique, I think. In the history of war fighting, there have always been reporters, but we had embedded reporters. All of our units had embedded reporters. And so the story was told, which was great. A lot of good pictures, a lot of good images came out of there. But hundreds and hundreds of Iraqi soldiers surrendered to us as we came across the border. So in addition to those that were actually fighting and engaging us, we were dealing with those who were surrendering. absolutely absurd and chaotic environment.
Wow, it's incredible. What did your time in the military teach you about yourself?
Wow, that's a big question. Yeah, that's a great question. There's so many things. I guess I could go a lot of different places with that. I learned a lot of things. I had a wife. We were married in college, so we were going through this entire military experience together. I had two little kids at the time that I went into Iraq. So that framed a lot of what I learned, learning how to maintain those relationships while also doing a job that required, so much time and so much effort and so much energy.
Right.
I did go into the Marine Corps, though, and I think this is true of a lot of people, with quite a bit of hubris. I think some of that is important. If you're going to go into combat, you need to have some confidence that you are going to be able to do what you can do. I remember having a conversation with my mom shortly before we deployed to Iraq, and she said something like this, or asked the question, "I just want to know that you believe that what you're doing is the right thing, that you believe you're going there for the right reason. And I need to know that you believe that." And my answer to her was, "I'm a Marine infantry officer. It doesn't matter what the situation is. We go where our country tells us to, whatever." I gave that kind of answer, very arrogant and overly confident. The first night of the war, I remember having the thought in the midst of all of the chaos of the rest of it. I thought about my mom asking that question and thinking, you know what? It really is important to know why we're here and what we're doing. I was humbled a great deal. I learned that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. I was not as capable of a leader as I thought I was. I learned a lot during my time in the Marine Corps about depending on other people, about how we must work together to accomplish big things. We can't do that on our own. So many unit dynamics, and unit not meaning military unit, but just people being together and accomplishing things together, each person doing their role well, working together can accomplish something amazing. So many lessons, which is why 20 years later, I'm still writing about these things and talking about these things and having discussions about them, because I'm constantly reflecting on them and constantly learning lessons. I tell a story about how after one pretty significant firefight on April 1st of 2003, I was overwhelmed with the thought that the enemy doesn't really care who I am. That doesn't mean anything to the enemy. Where I went to school, what I look like, all the things we argue about right now, the enemy doesn't care. The enemy wants to destroy you, and use that metaphor however you will in your life. But what that brought me to was a clear understanding that I can only can control what I can control. I can't control the rest. I need to stop worrying about the periphery, all this stuff that just doesn't matter, and really focus on what I'm here to do. In combat, that's pretty clear. In life, it's less clear. But man, that's been an important lesson for me. So a lot of things. And I continue to learn lessons. I continue to reflect. And it's funny how a relatively short period of time in your life can have such a strong impact on you.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeremy. No, thank you so much. I'd love to know, what would you say is the biggest myth or misconception about the military?
Ooh, the biggest. Wow. See, that's an interesting word, right? I don't know what the biggest myth is. I'll tell you one of the myths that I like to destroy whenever I have the opportunity. Less than 1% of the United States serves in the military. We're at a weird time in American history where it's a it's a very small percentage of people serve in the military. And there seems to be a pervading thought that the people who serve in the military are doing so because they have nowhere else to go. That these are folks who didn't have other job options. They didn't have other things that they could do. And this was an easy route for them. And certainly for some people, that would be the case. I will tell you, though, I have never in my life served with people who were more intelligent, meaning very high IQ people, more capable. You are literally, as an enlisted Marine at 19, 20 years old, making life and death decisions based on the training that you either received or didn't receive, or what you learned or didn't learn. You're making decisions for yourself, for your fellow service members, and for the civilians that you happen to be interacting with. Mm-hmm. All of this is happening in real time in the brain of a kid that, we would say, well, they're not old enough to hold down a real job. We mock kind of this young generation, right? They play video games. It's all they care about. They play in a combat environment. That is who is making national policy level global politics altering decisions. And so it's always interesting to me when people talk about those who go into the military as, you know, their IQ is lower, their education was not what it needed to be, they didn't have a lot of job opportunities, et cetera. Again, I know that is true of some people, but by and large, the quality of young men and women that serve in our military is extremely high, which is why we're able to do the things we are in the environments that we are in such a significant way. A lot of officers, a lot of leaders, but the vast majority of service members are young people who are making very important decisions, and they're doing it very, very well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And maybe just to add on to that, so you don't know this about me, Jeremy, but both of my brothers have actually served.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, one of whom, Matt, is about 11 months younger than me, and he served in the Marines. And wow, just to put some context on the IQ thing, he decided to become a doctor, and he's currently a doctor in Texas. Yeah. So not something someone with a low IQ would do, I don't think.
No, it's crazy, you know, and now I have 20 years between my service and now, and I look back at a lot of these guys I served with, and man, it's crazy. Attorneys, and as you mentioned, doctors and, you know, business owners and all of the things that they're doing. This was a starting point in their life. It was something they wanted to do. They did it really, really well. And then they moved on and did something else. So that is a myth. And I think we need to be very careful about how we view our military. Yeah. And that's one of the myths, is that, well, they didn't have any other options anyhow. That's just not true for most people.
Right. Right. I would feel as you do, for sure. How important has faith been in your life, Jeremy?
Faith is everything. My entire life is based on my perspective of faith. I'm a Christian. I was raised in a Christian home. This story that I just mentioned after the firefight, where I had to realize I could only control what I needed to control, that was a moment in my life at 25 where I probably for the first time really realized, even as a Christian, you know, God is bigger than this. God is in control. I'm not in control. Now, He allows me to be in control of some things, and I need to be diligent about that. But I can rest, if you will, or take confidence, have faith in the fact that He is bigger than all of this. And the lessons that I learn, I try to contextualize in a faith context. The programs that we run are all what we call faith-based programs, meaning simply we believe that God created us. And if He created us, then there's purpose. Mm-hmm. And if there's purpose and design, then we can move beyond whatever obstacles or difficulties or trials we happen to be dealing with. And so faith is the foundation for my entire life. And I view everything through that faith lens or that faith perspective.
Sure. Sure. Understood. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but I'd love to hear a bit more about the Mighty Oaks Foundation. How did it get started and what is its purpose?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we work with veterans, active duty service members, first responders. That would be, you know, first responder community is large, but primarily police officers and firefighters, others as well, but emergency workers and spouses. So a lot of our service members, you know, they're married to folks who are dealing with things. And so spouses as well. And it was really started, the Mighty Oaks Foundation was started. Our founder, Chad Robichaux, and his wife, Chad had served in the Marine Corps as well, had struggled, you know, severely with post-traumatic stress, came home, tried a lot of different things. A mentor stepped into his life and, you know, helped him understand that what he was missing in all these attempts to deal with his trauma and his post-traumatic stress was an acknowledgement of faith, acknowledgement of God, and walked him through that. And so he and his family decided they wanted to help other people who are dealing with some of the same things. And he and I met, and he had started Mighty Oaks and asked if I'd help develop this and build it out. And we did that as a way, honestly, to, I think the phrase is pay it forward, but it's helping other people to understand how we move forward in our own lives. When I came back from Iraq, I struggled a lot, even though I was working on a church staff. I was a complete disaster for about a year and really needed people to speak into my life and needed people to come around me and help me to get back on my feet and help me to move forward. And so Mighty Oaks was very much that. It was us saying, who can we help? And we started with people that we knew. We brought them to, at the time we were using a facility in Colorado, spend a week with us, talk about trauma, what it is, what it isn't, but more importantly, some principles you can use to move forward in spite of it. And at the time, we thought that we would reach some people, but probably not very many. And that was 2012. And to date, we've had over 4,500 people attend one of those week-long programs. We have five facilities across the country. Wow. And we're on track now to reach 1,000 people a year. So, you know, 4,500 over the last 10 years or so, And now we're at a place where we have about close to this year, we'll have 1,000 students that will go through one of those week-long programs. And, you know, principally, it's very simple. Most of the people that have attended our programs have already been clinically diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, have gone through, you know, clinical therapies and, you know, medical interventions and those kind of things, but are struggling to really get a handle on it. So those are helping, but they're not, they have not been a solution. And so most of the people who attend our program have already been through all that. They come to us and we talk about how, again, we believe that God is. If God is, he created. If he created, then there's purpose and design. That's so important. You and I had talked about this before, but identity. If God created us with purpose and design, we need to understand that and find our identity in that instead of in trauma, brokenness, hurt, bad decisions, the death or loss of people that we care about. We need to find our identity in what he created us to do and to be. And when we understand that and then we align to that, it changes everything in our lives. Not that we forget what's happened to us or get over what's happened to us, because we never will. It's part of who we are. But those things, whatever those things are, can be used as part of our story to be a benefit to others, but they don't bind us anymore. They don't have us in chains anymore. We're not tied to the past anymore. We can move forward in a meaningful way. And we've been communicating that message again for over 10 years. Our core program called the Legacy Program, it's 5 days. And that's what we do in that 5 days. And then beyond that, we have a pretty robust, what we call aftercare, which is, you know, connecting to counselors and organizations and other ways that we can continue to help people who have graduated from our program. And we've been super blessed with donors who make that program free to anyone who can attend. And in addition to that, because our program's across the country, we cover the cost of travel to get there. So for a man or woman who wants to attend one of those sessions, they need to apply, but it will not cost them anything other than the 5 days of the program. And we've seen tremendous success. It's been pretty incredible, actually.
That's wonderful, Jeremy. One question I had, and I think nothing hinges on it, and I'll even edit it out if it becomes pointless, but I am curious if you've done any work with the Gary Sinise Foundation.
I have connected to several folks at Gary Sinise Foundation. We haven't done, so there are a lot of veteran service organizations, as you can imagine, and a lot of them are kind of out here doing whatever they're doing, but some do connect. There's lines that we cross, and we cross a lot of lines with Gary Sinise and the work that he does. We have not had a partnership with them, but we have had people that they know they run into that need a program like ours, and they'll recommend them over to us. And so we've had those points of communication and we've made that happen. Likewise, people that have graduated from our program will push their direction as well. So cooperation, but not partnership.
Excellent. Wonderful. I have just a couple questions left, Jeremy. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, man. Appreciate the time, by the way.
Oh, for sure.
So there's more than 1.5 million nonprofit organizations in the U.S. alone. With that in mind, I would imagine it's fairly difficult to stand out. And I'm just curious, is there anything that you wish more people knew about your organization and the families that you help?
Yeah, that's a big number. There are 44, almost 45,000 veteran service organizations as part of that 1.5 million nonprofits in the United States. So there are a lot of organizations for sure. I will say this about us, and we're not alone in this, but it's a very small group. We are focused on a solution. A lot of, particularly in the veteran space, the veteran nonprofit space, a lot of the conversation is about the problem. A lot of the nonprofits that exist for veterans are about highlighting or illustrating the problem of more than 20 veterans a day committing suicide, the problem of broken homes, the problem of substance abuse, the problem of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental disorders. A lot of the organizations that exist are about highlighting or illustrating the problem. So that's one thing. We are very focused on a solution. We understand there's a problem, but how can we help people move beyond that? So another segment of veteran service organizations are about activities. There is nothing wrong with that. But it's about serving those who have served. So we want to take veterans on trips or provide things for veterans, you know, other good things that support and encourage veterans and express thanks and gratitude to them and help them. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, that's not what we do. We try to directly confront or intersect the trauma, the brokenness, and the hurt that people are dealing with, and then ask the question, how can we move forward in spite of that? And that's where we are very much peer mentor focused. Every person who teaches in our program is a graduate of our program. Mm. Every team leader who leads small groups during that week has graduated from our program. It's very much a program where the person standing in front of the class says, I know where you are because I've been there. I know what you're going through because I've gone through something very similar. Let me tell you my story, my struggles, my hurts, my brokenness, and then how I began to move forward so that we can begin moving forward together. So we're unique in that sense. We very much do our best to intersect with points of brokenness and hurt using our own stories and our own experience, helping people to move forward.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeremy. I'd love to know, are there any specific moments or success stories that you're most proud of that show how your organization is making a difference in people's lives?
Yeah, we've had so many, again, with more than 4,500 graduates of the program. And then in addition to our legacy program, our five-day program, we speak across the country and in conferences and events. So literally tens of thousands of folks we've had the opportunity to speak to. Specific examples, there are a lot. I'll tell one story. There was a United States Marine, and we have people who aren't Marines come to our program, by the way. People are always like, yeah, it's a Marine program. It's not. It's for everyone, but we love Marines. United States Marine came to our program, and he was a retired master guns, so an E-9. He had spent almost 30 years in the Marine Corps. He retired from the Marine Corps because of some bad decisions that he made toward the end of his career. Substance abuse became a problem for him. Again, he had served a long time, has served well, had led a multinational coalition during the war, had led very, very well. And then his substance abuse and alcoholism became too much, caused a lot of problems, and he was forced to retire. This is a bad situation, obviously. From there, his life spun out of control, as you can imagine. He had led at a very high level. He was very well respected. Now he was out of the Marine Corps under less than desirable circumstances. His life spiraled out of control to the point that eventually his wife hadn't seen him for about a week. He left the house. She couldn't find him. She eventually found him after a week of looking in a hotel. And she tells the story, and I've heard him tell the story. Found him, had the manager of the hotel open the door. And when she opened the door on the sixth floor of this hotel, he was standing next to the window. She had been yelling to get him to open the door. He knew she was there. The door was finally open. He was standing next to the window. He said goodbye, and he turned around and jumped out of the sixth-story window. Crazy set of circumstances. And, you know, I believe in the providence of God. He fell six stories, missed the sidewalk by feet, and there was some problem with the sprinklers or whatever that watered the grass next to the sidewalk. So it was muddy and soft, and that's where he landed.
Wow.
Broke several bones, took a long time to rehabilitate before he could walk again, but didn't die. He came to our program shortly after he got out of the hospital. He was walking with one of those canes that has the four things on the bottom, you know, mm-hmm. the big thing. So he's leaning on that. And he came through and spent a week with us. I'll never forget the picture, the image of him standing there telling his story and talking about his time in the Marine Corps and what he had done and how he felt like when he left the Marine Corps, he could no longer lead and he could no longer be useful. And that he realized that the Marine Corps is not what made him a leader or useful. And even though he was broken and he was hurt, he was recovering, he knew he could continue to serve others. And that's what he did. He worked with us for a long time. He was the guy that would chase people down and say, you need help, and I'm going to get you the place where you need help. The understanding of his identity and the fact that it wasn't in the Marine Corps or in service, it changed his life, and it changed his marriage, and it changed what he did with the rest of his life or has been doing with the rest of his life. So that's one example. They're not all that dramatic, but a lot of them are. A lot of stories of families restored. And, you know, on the first night of our program, we ask people to tell us why they're there. And often, it's, I'm here because I have nowhere else to go. I've tried everything else. And if this doesn't work, then when I go home, I will end my life. And getting to the end of a week where that same person will tell a completely different story and begin to put the pieces back together. Again, we've seen that over and over and over again.
Wow. That's incredible, Jeremy. That's an amazing story. Jeremy Stalnecker, how can people find out about you, sir?
Yeah. For the Mighty Oaks Foundation, go to mightyoaksprograms.org, mightyoaksprograms.org. A lot of information about Mighty Oaks. Resources are there, videos, all kinds of resources. There's also an application. If you are a veteran, active duty service member, first responder, or the spouse of one, you can fill out an application that goes to our team, and we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. We'll figure out a time where you can attend. And again, there's no cost to you. So that's all there, mightyoaksprograms.org. And then for me personally, I have a blog, a couple of podcasts that I'm involved with, my social media stuff, a couple of books that I've written. That can all be found just using my name, jeremystalnaker.com. And that will take you to all of those resources, kind of one stop. So check that out. So mightyoaksprograms.org and jeremystalnaker.com.
Yeah, fantastic, Jeremy. I'll make sure I leave all those links in our show notes as well. And then last thing, you're the host of the March or Die podcast, which has a very special guest coming up, I understand.
Yeah, yeah, we got a great guest coming up next week.
For our listeners, I actually appeared on his podcast as a guest recently. But yeah, what prompted you to start the March or Die podcast?
I wrote a book several years ago called March or Die, and it's a series of stories from my time in Iraq. And I'll talk about an event and then make an application to life. It's not just about telling the story. It's about what was the lesson learned here. And I tell the story in there about a day we had a major firefight and it got crazy. And for the first time in my life, I realized that when you're faced with these overwhelming circumstances, you have to decide what you're going to do. You can stay where you are and die. I mean, that's a choice we can make. And for most people, that's not physical. It's emotional or spiritual or relational. It's that I'm not doing anything significant or important. I'm just going to stay here. It's all too hard. You can do that, or you can march. And that's putting one foot in front of the other and continuing to move forward, overcoming the obstacles, the trials, the difficulties, and the traumas in your life. So I tell that story. That's what the book is called, and that's what it's based on. And then started a podcast talking about principles for moving forward, how we can move forward, principles for just looking at the world around us and understanding what is important and what is not important. So often it's me just teaching a principle. And then quite often it's having a guest like yourself or many others on to help kind of break that down in real time.
Wonderful, Jeremy. Jeremy, thank you so much for taking time for me on this. I really appreciate it.
Josh, I really appreciate you. And yeah, it's exciting. It's been a fun day.
Yeah, no, it really has. Well, thanks, man. You enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.